Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio, internet talk radio recorded from the west coast of Sweden. My name is Henrik Palmgren and our website is redicecreations.com. We have a new program for you every Thursday and Sunday that you can tune into. You can access our archive of regular shows for free, dating all the way back to our start over a year ago. We also have a subscriber section that you definitely don't want to miss out on if you want to enjoy everything that we have to offer in our radio archive. Today we have Craig Haynes with us on the program, and we are going to dive into talking about Craig's book Gateway of the Gods, the theme of the Watchers or the Nephilim, and also the Gateway or / Stargate is something that we definitely are interested in on this radio show, and it's great to hear a new voice in this field also. We spent some time last week, I think it was, with Tom Horn talking a little bit about the Nephilim also, and we'll see where we end up here today talking about Craig's book. It's going to be a lot of fun to hear from Craig and from a new voice, as I said. So the website also that you should check out right away is gatewayofthegods.com. A beautiful looking site with much more information about the book and about Craig himself. So let's bring on our guest and get this program going. Welcome to the program, Craig, and thank you so much for spending some time with us here today.
Oh, hi, Henrik, and thank you for inviting me onto the show.
Excellent. It's nice to have you with us. You know, before we, you know, dive into talking a little bit about your book, this is your first time on the program. I don't know if people out there are familiar with you. I know that you've been on Lou Gentili, and you're going to be on Coast to Coast soon, so I guess your name is getting more and more out there, as it were. But before we dive into talking about your book, maybe you could mention a little bit about yourself, your background, and your interest in this subject.
Sure. Well, I mean, I've had a lifelong interest in the paranormal, but for most of my life growing up, I was always involved in multimedia projects like video production and computer artwork. So that was the kind of career that I was pursuing. Everyone who knew me in school knew that that's what I was going to do. Basically, though, by the time it came for graduation, one thing led to another, and I just deeply got involved in the research that later became this book. I threw myself into the topic of ancient texts, ancient cultures, theoretical physics, and it took 7 long years, but the book is finally available.
Excellent. You know, you mentioned computer graphics and art and so forth. Looking at your website and, of course, your book cover, both were very beautiful. Are you behind that in any way?
Yeah, I was intimately involved in every aspect. I, you know, was involved in creating the cover artwork and the interior layout, the website. I'm actually planning on doing an overhaul and a complete revision of that very soon, but just haven't gotten around to it.
Okay, oh, really? Do you work like with only with the digital graphics, or do you paint and stuff like that too?
I do some paint, but it's mostly digital. I'm a certified Adobe nut.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. I have just about every Adobe product made.
Okay, yeah, there you go. Are you involved in any, you know, since Adobe is involved in film material, are you that a field too that you're into, making video or film?
Yes, I haven't been able to do that recently, but I'm trying to find further ways to integrate my own research with the book and other topics that I'm interested in, with maybe some future video projects and or online video projects.
Excellent. You know, this topic, as we said, of course, about the Watchers and so forth, is definitely getting out there, as it were. A lot of films in a way or another seems to be, you know, doing their research too, as it were, the screenwriters and so forth, and this is something that is out there. And, you know, let us begin talk a little bit about these gods, as it were. They go under many names. The Watchers, some call them the Nephilim or the Sons of God, and even the depictions and the physical descriptions are very varied. Some call them the Shining Ones. Others refer to them as the Giants and so forth. There's a lot of different elements we can bring in here to describe this. And Craig, what have you found in your research? Who or what are the Watchers?
Well, a very complicated topic there. We have to distill down. Over the years, I read numerous theories. So my ideas on this have ranged from originally angels to then it was space aliens, and now I'm back to angels, but with a different interpretation on what an angelic being is. So it's really been all over the spectrum, but the Watchers specifically, if we refer back to the ancient texts such as the Book of Enoch, they were called the Sons of God, and they were these beings that allegedly came from heaven, and they came here to teach humankind and instruct them in certain ways of civilization and proper conduct. Unfortunately, according to the text, they also became enamored with the lovely women, and one thing led to another with that, and so there was a lot of anarchy that spread about the land as these hybrid offspring were born to them that were known as the Nephilim.
Have you read a lot of Zachariah Sitchin, that type of material? I mean, we could go back to, as you say, the Bible, or we have the what is it called, the Nagamari Library, and so forth. Is this sources that you derive for your work from?
Yeah, actually, I touched upon all of those for my research. For a while there, I was into the research of Zachariah Sitchin, as many people were. However, the more that I researched his material, the more I realized that not everything was as accurate or perhaps even as truthful as some people would be led to believe. And so it required a major revision of my thinking about it. But I think that now with what I've learned, I can go back to the ancient text and let the text speak for themselves, and we don't need to start reinterpreting specific words and things to mean what we want them to believe. Just let them say what they do, and we can get a much more clear, a clearer picture of the story.
You know, one thing I know that has been difficult, and also, of course, why Sitchin got a lot of attention back in, when was this, 70s or 80s, something like
that. Yeah, I think he published in the 70s and a lot during the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. And one of the advantages, as it were, that he had was that he was the one, you know, who actually could read a cuneiform, I guess. And at the time, there weren't a lot of people around who actually could do that. But do you know if there's more people and more researchers around these days that actually can look at the same material as Sitchin did and actually reinterpret some of that too?
Well, yes. Specifically, I would recommend people check out the work of Dr. Michael Heiser. Now, this might get me into some hot water because I know that there are a lot of people that follow Sitchin's work, but Dr. Heiser has spent the last few years showing how Sitchin does not understand the ancient languages, and he takes great leaps of logic in his reinterpreting, and that actually I highly doubt that he can read a lot of the languages that he claims he does.
Interesting.
Because Dr. Heiser has pointed out many grammatical errors and things, which I even point out in my book, that Sitchin, if he really knew the languages, it's inexcusable for the mistakes that he made. I can catch them, and I don't even have a background in Hebrew and Aramaic.
So what is that all about, do you think? I mean,
I'm not really sure. I mean, like I said, I don't want to speak ill of Sitchin because he has done a lot of good to bring this topic and give it the attention that it deserves. It's just, unfortunately, I think too many people believe that, like, they hang on his every word and that they think that he does have this skill, but he's never presented the actual credentials. He's been asked numerous times to show where he went to school to learn these languages, and to my knowledge, he hasn't done so. For instance, I mentioned in the book, but I got permission from Dr. Heiser to reproduce it. I think it was in Sitchin's book, The Stairway to Heaven. He's reinterpreting one of the lines where it was saying he was trying to equate the Watchers as being the Nephilim, and specifically, he mentions right in his own text, he says, but nowhere in this writing does it say Watchers, it says Nephilim. But unfortunately, the problem is that whenever he reproduces the actual Aramaic letters, he mistakenly refers to it as Hebrew, but you can tell that it's Aramaic based upon the endings of the words. That's the first mistake. other one is he says that the word watchers does not appear anywhere in that line of text,
mm-hmm.
and it's right there in the middle.
Hmm.
So the very word he's telling his audience does not exist in that line
mm.
is smack dab in the text in his own book.
Oh my.
So if he really knew how to read that, he mixes up Hebrew and Aramaic, and then the very word he's telling everyone isn't in that line is right there in the middle.
Huh.
So I think that that's a major thing that opened up my eyes to questioning his abilities.
Mm, yeah, definitely. I definitely understand that. You know, do you think that is there any significance in the interpretation of the names? I mean, as I said in the beginning, there are a lot of names to, you know, we could say the Watchers or the Nephilim or you know, Sons of God or whatever. But do you think there's a reason for the name? Is that a thing that is very important to you? Do you refer
it
to?
It is. Mm. Based upon my research, I've seen so many different names applied to these beings,
mm.
but many times they all equate to roughly the same thing. Like a lot of them mean Shining Ones.
Yeah.
And it's descriptive. You have the Hebrew term El or Elohim, which not only means God, but it has the connotation based upon where it's derived in ancient Akkadian and Babylonian text with meaning mighty man or shining one.
Yeah.
But so not only do you have the word El meaning God and shining one, but then you move to like Anglo-Saxon languages and you have the word elf.
Ah,
which
yeah.
Everyone has heard about elves, but you have that same sound, and what it originally meant was a shining, radiant being.
Hmm. Interesting.
So all over the world, you have these same descriptions, and while the words change, which is expected to hmm. happen as the words evolve over time and pass through different cultures, there's still this core to the words that you can pick out, and they have the same meaning, even if it sounds different in another language.
Very interesting, and this, you know, right away actually, you know, brings us into the topic of the some people refer to it as the first language or the original language, which in a way I guess is even connected with the Tower of Babel. Would you say that's correct?
Oh, definitely, because the whole story behind the Tower of Babel was that basically humans wanted to make this tower to reach heaven, and according to the story, God sees this from in heaven, and he comes down with the divine council and says, this can't happen. If they are able to achieve this, nothing will be impossible for them, and so we must stop it. And so then you have this clever wordplay between the Hebrew word Baalel, which means to mix or confuse, with the Babylonian term Babel.
Hmm.
And so the whole Tower of Babel story is a clever pun on the part of the Hebrew writers of the Bible,
hmm.
Describing this, because the actual term Babel means gateway of God, which is where I derive the title of the book.
Hmm. Oh, very interesting. And what is it? Isn't it a word, Etemenanki, is involved in that too? Do you know if that is that a...
That's the Sumerian term. That means hmm. the foundation of heaven and earth.
Okay.
And that is what they referred to these ancient ziggurats, which were the stepped pyramids, where they built these structures, and they claimed that at the top there was some sort of device or portal that would allow the gods to traverse the heavens and come to earth through this portal or this gateway.
Hmm. Very interesting.
Hence, like I said, the term Babel means gateway of God.
Yeah, yeah. And I know also that in your book you also connect even the tarot with the ancient knowledge, I guess, with this, and especially in that context, of course, the tarot card, the tower, isn't that right?
Yes, it is. It's not so much that I'm connecting it like directly to the tarot, but it's more that I've noticed throughout all my research that these same themes keep appearing over and over again in a variety of different forms, but they all point back to the same item, and that's referring to the story of the Tower of Babel and humankind's goal to reach the heavens and become like the gods.
Mm. So, I mean, if we were to return a little bit to the question of who these beings were, is there at this point in your work any particular theory, as it were, that you actually favor. You know, I mean, we have the ancient aliens theory, or then we have the more, I guess, spiritual or religious take on it, that these are, you know, I guess, demons or you know, semi-angels or something like that. Is there some of this info that you favor in front of the other?
Actually, it's a combination of both. I would say I don't want to refer to them as aliens or even extraterrestrials, except in the sense of they're not of Earth. Mm. The ancient texts make that clear.
Mm.
I also, throughout my research, try to remain neutral and not try to put a religious spin or aspect onto it. So I'm not trying to allow any of my personal beliefs or, you know, religious beliefs to enter into this and to just look at the text.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so basically what the texts say about these beings are that they are, they're referred to as angels, which mean messengers of God or princes and kings, and that they reside in this other realm, which we call heaven, and that they have the ability to move into our dimension through these gateways. And so I'm not sure what form exactly they take while residing in this heavenly dimension,
mm-hmm.
But whenever they come to Earth, they actually are able to take on physical flesh and blood properties so that they can directly interact with the people and environment.
Hmm.
And I believe that's part of the reason what these gateways functioned as is a translation device so that they can move from one dimension to the other, and it give them the proper body and context to interact with us.
Interesting. Yeah, we definitely want to dive into a little bit talking about these, you know, gateways, as it were, what it is and so forth. But before we go there, one thing that pops to mind, of course, is if there are ancient records about these beings and so forth, you know, being here on this planet, do you think that there actually is some still left, or if they're, you know, have departed, as it were, do you think that they actually could be returning at some point?
Well, that's difficult to answer. My personal view is no, they are not still here. That does not mean that their influences can't still be felt, even from events that happened in the past. But I don't consider that they're moving freely around, because, to my knowledge, I have not seen any indication that there is an active gateway, so to speak, like what was described in the ancient world.
Hmm.
So, according to the text, after the incident that happened with the sons of God mating with human women, like I said, there was a lot of chaos, and according to some of the text, that was the reason for the global flood and disasters, and many of these angels were punished for their deeds, and they were imprisoned in another realm, and these gateways were then deactivated so that it couldn't happen again.
Hmm.
So, to my knowledge, I'm not aware of anything that they're actually here now, still walking around, or that they're even, say, scheduled to return, because I really think that if there's any return on their part, mm-hmm. it's actually going to be of our own doing, but it's just a question of how we want to go about this, and if we're careful, maybe we can contact the good guys instead of making the mistake and contacting the bad guys first.
This opens up a lot of questions, of course. You know, our own making. I definitely want to talk about that a little bit. But would you go so far, you know, in that way to say that you attribute these specific watchers to actually be, can I use the word evil or bad or negative in a way, or are they?
Again, it depends upon the context. Many of the Watchers, I think they made poor decisions, and they obviously went against the laws, so to speak, that they were given, saying, like, this is what you're supposed to do and this is what you're not supposed to do.
Mm.
So they obviously disobeyed in that area.
Mm.
However, many of the things that they taught are things which the texts actually say were knowledge and secrets that were reserved for use in heaven. So it's not that the information that they brought to mankind was bad, it's just that, you know, information is power.
Mm.
At that time, they were providing us with too much information.
Hmm.
Now, again, going along with saying about evil, some of them were evil. For a specific example, there's the angel Azazel, who he was the one blamed for most of the crimes, for teaching warfare and destruction, and among other things. So his activities I would definitely attribute as being evil or malevolent, but not all of them. Continuing with that, though, a lot of people want to call them demons, and according to the ancient text, that is not accurate. They're fallen gods or fallen angels. The text actually referred to them, they are gods. They are part of the divine council. A lot of people don't like to hear that because they say that, you know, there's only one God, but the texts say that there is only one supreme God by the name of Yahweh, but there are lesser gods that work under his authority, and so they do have the title of a god. They're just not equal to Yahweh. Now, their offspring, the Nephilim, are actually the origin of demonic spirits, according to these texts, because it says that, you know, whenever you read the Book of Enoch, it explains that after these Nephilim beings were slain, because they were born of the earth instead of being born in a heavenly dimension, that their spirits were tied to the earth just like human spirits are tied to the earth. And so whenever their bodies were slain, their spirits must remain upon the earth, and so they became labeled as demons. It was known as the Shadim. And so I think that actually answers a lot of questions, too, because you hear a lot of stories about demonic possession, where these spirits are trying to inhabit human bodies. And I've never heard a better explanation than whenever I was reading the ancient text and saying that the reason why these demons seek to possess human bodies is because they are denied the bodies that they once had, and they're trapped in our dimension.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So this is, in a way, then I guess this is the most, you know, active or you know, how this is very close we humans at this point in time can get to them, because as you say, if actually a human actually can be possessed by you know, one of these entities, and actually through consequently through that actually influence, you know, events here on earth or something like that. So in a way there is a direct contact, but it's more obscure, as it were, I guess.
Yeah, and it also, like I said, referring to this demonic aspect to it in the possessions, that's why I've always been skeptical of a lot of the claims of demonic possession that I've seen on television or things, where it doesn't seem to match what the ancient texts actually describe. And so I more think that it's just people sort of falling prey and into this way of thinking what their upbringing taught them it's supposed to be, rather than actually a legitimate event where they're really demonically possessed.
Okay, yeah. You know, one thing also, of course, is that I'm thinking about is, do you think that the best account for the I don't know, creation or birth of the Nephilim is in the Genesis 6 in the Bible? Do you think that is most, you know, clear or proof, as it were, from ancient text, or is there, you know, other scriptures that actually explain this even more or more detail, something like that?
I'm not aware of specific details. The general account given between the Bible and other ancient texts was that the Nephilim were born of human women that mated with these fallen angels. And it, sometimes in the ancient astronaut theories, they want to equate things with like test tubes and labs and things like that. But I just don't see evidence for that upon my reading of the text. They refer to women giving birth, and a lot of times they would say that the women would die during childbirth because the babies were larger than normal, and so they would have to be born via cesarean section.
Yeah.
So that's one aspect, but also, too, it, just the whole genetics of it and the bloodlines are something that I really delved into with my research, because I felt that many other researchers weren't even covering the topic or doing it any kind of justice.
Yeah, definitely. That is definitely an area that I did want to go into, about the bloodlines. I know that you write about this, and this is a theme in a way that is, I guess, attributed even to, you know, conspiracy research and you know, these kinds of fields, as it were. And I mean, what's your take on it all? What would you say would define as these bloodlines? Is it, you know, ancient dynasties, or is there something more to the story here?
Well, I don't go completely into some of the conspiracy theories as I've heard with some other researchers, but I will give you that according to the ancient methods and practices that the kings ruled because they were believed to have been descended from the gods, and so they had the blood of the gods coursing through their veins. That was their divine right to rule.
Mm.
And so that was the reason why they were appointed as kings and ruled over, and why they tried to keep things within the family was about keeping that bloodline.
Yeah.
Now, as far as what I've uncovered with the actual genetics and everything of that nature regarding the fallen angels, many researchers only briefly described that the Watchers were described with having white skin, white hair, and oftentimes with blue eyes, although sometimes you have varying descriptions, and that they might have even had a luminous appearance to them. And as I said, many researchers will mention this, but then they don't go any further, and I'm just like, whoa, wait a minute, that seems pretty significant. Why are they described with white skin, not like a person, you know, a Caucasian person, but more like an albino?
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems highly relevant to me. And so I started thinking about this, and there's numerous descriptions of these beings with the white skin and white hair, and what we know about genetics today, we know that that's passed down from our parents. You inherit your skin color and your hair color and everything like that. And as you're growing up, based upon the amount of melanin in your hair and things, that determines your hair color, and the other genes in the sunlight affect your skin color. So people who live closer to the equator have darker colored skin to protect them from the UV rays, and the further north you move, you know, paler skin. And so I was looking into that and saying, well, why would they all be described with this very pale skin? I mean, Noah was described with it. He was even mistaken. His father was concerned that he was a child of the Watchers.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, that's an important aspect. And then even Jesus is described in the Bible with white skin, white hair. You just need to refer to the beginning of the book of Revelation where they describe him like that. And part of the thing is, though, then if you read in the book of Hebrews, it compares Jesus to Melchizedek, and it says he was of the same priestly line. The really interesting part about that is Melchizedek only had one other appearance in the Old Testament whenever he blessed Abraham, and therefore also founded, Abraham was the founder of the Judeo-Christian and Islamic religions. But Melchizedek was considered the high priest of God and also an angelic being. Now, referring again in the New Testament to Melchizedek, it says that he was without father, without mother, without genealogy. So whenever I started thinking about that, it's like, wait, it says he didn't have any parents or any genetic history. And again, some people would go with an ancient astronaut theory saying, well, he was born in a test tube, or it was some sort of creation in a lab.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, wait, no, if it's describing them coming through this gateway and they were translated into our dimension, I thought, well, what if this gateway device is actually giving them, it's taking the atoms in our realm and assembling a body for them, that then their spirit inhabits this body. But it's a brand new body. It doesn't need to be born or anything like that, so it doesn't inherit any genetics from its parents because there are no parents. So therefore, it would have white skin, white hair, very pale eyes, just like the text describe.
Very interesting. And let's talk a little bit about these gateways, as it were. Is this involved in any way then with the technology? Is it some kind of magical ritual, or what's your take on that?
I'm not quite sure. If you go back and read the text, it becomes very difficult to separate the religious aspects of it from any sort of technological aspect. I do believe that it was some sort of technology, but the only records that we have are given to us by our ancient ancestors, and they might not have necessarily been the ones to really understand how this worked. So to them, it appeared as magic, and that's how they might have described it.
Mm.
But, you know, who knows how it actually functioned. But, as I said, numerous times all throughout these texts, there are references to these ancient pyramids that were built, and I don't believe that the pyramids themselves actually functioned as the gateways, but they were meant to convey other information, such as calendar systems, or just for ritual purposes. But at the top is where this device or gateway, however it was, or however it functioned, and that's where it was kept. And so that is where these, it would assemble and form the body for these angels to come from the heavenly dimension and be translated into our dimension.
Hmm. Do you know if there are any kind of traces of these, if they were standing on the top of, let's say, step pyramids or something like that? Do you know if there are any traces left of these devices, I guess, or machines or structures or whatever they might be?
No, unfortunately, most of the ziggurats are all destroyed, or there's only some that parts of them remain, but the very tops of them have all been dismantled or just worn down over time.
Hmm.
Now, even the Great Pyramid of Egypt, again, I think that the pyramid shape itself is meant to convey other symbolic information, but if we refer back to what its intended purpose was, it was supposed to be a resurrection machine for the pharaoh.
Yeah.
And so I believe that that was actually intended as a device for the pharaoh himself to then move from our realm into the heavenly realm.
Hmm.
And that might also explain why there was never any body found within any of the pyramids. I mean, you have the typical answer is that through grave robbery and things like that, that the bodies were removed, which is quite possible. But it's not the only answer, especially given the context of what we are told about why these pyramids were built.
Hmm.
And they say that they were meant to function as resurrection machines.
Very interesting. Of course, we have the Pyramidion on top of the Great Pyramid that, you know, actually is gone itself. Is there a connection there, I think?
I'm not sure. The only connection I'm aware of is that, according to the legends, it was supposed to be either made of gold or plated in gold.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And gold is another aspect. It plays an important part in all the research. It was supposed to be this very special element to the gods and involved in this resurrection process.
So yeah.
I don't know what role specifically the Pyramidion had, but I do know that again and again it keeps coming up, and all we have are the ancient texts where it describes about how the phoenix, that's the Greek term, but in the Egyptian it was known as the Bennu bird, perch upon this Pyramidion, which was known as the Benben. Okay, and so you have this, again, the symbolism of the phoenix, which dies in this fire, which the fire is another important aspect of the gateways, but then is reborn through the same fire.
Hmm.
So, like I said, I can't tell you any more than what the texts say,
yeah.
And it's rather mysterious, but there is a definite connection there, but specifically what it is, I cannot tell you.
Hmm. Yeah, as you say also, of course, the fascination with gold seems to be, I know that Sitchin talks about this also, and I think in the context of these beings who actually, you know, live on a planet that has been destroyed and actually trying to, I think, repair their own atmosphere with gold. And another aspect of the gold issue, of course, is there is a lot of research around these days around something known as white powdered gold. Have you ever heard about that?
Yes, actually, I cover that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, as far as Sitchin, I don't agree with the whole mining of the gold to repair their atmosphere.
Mm.
But moving along with the white powder gold, that is something that I cover in the book, although I stress to people that everything that I cover in the book is as much as I was able to research it. I have not been able to verify a lot of the information of a man named David Hudson, who supposedly discovered this during the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And So he discovered this material, and it's supposed to have all these amazing properties. So I'm not sure. I really hope that somebody with a better scientific background can pick up my book, read all the other context information surrounding these ancient myths, and then maybe they'll have the technology or know-how to go about verifying this information that David Hudson claims about this monatomic white powder gold. Because I do think that that does, it holds the very key to solving part of this mystery if it's true. Well, if it's not, we'll have to go back and revise the theories and start over again and go down a different path. But from what I've put together, that seems to be the leading thing I would want people to investigate thoroughly.
Interesting. And we also have the, isn't there an account, I think, when Moses descends from the mountain with the tablets? That actually, you know, actually burns the golden calf, I think, or something like that. Isn't that right?
Yeah. It's very mysterious, and most scholars don't even address it. Everyone knows the story about them worshiping the golden calf, but a lot of people don't realize, unless they go back and reread the text, that it says that Moses took this gold and he burned it, and he actually made, you know, made it into a powder, which then he threw into the water and made the Israelites drink it. Now, it seems really weird that, you know, if you burn gold, you're going to have molten gold, and I mean, that would kill you if you tried to eat it. So, I mean, this whole description is rather mysterious, but so he goes and does that, and it doesn't really give any other information as to why he does this, but I think that is a clue, because it seems to be referring to this white powder gold or this monatomic gold. And it's also very similar in description to the heavenly material known as manna, which was also known as the food of the angels. And it was meant to, you know, sustain the Israelites while they were in the desert. And Jesus himself refers to this heavenly manna as being a key to the resurrection in the end of days.
Very interesting. You know, one thing I did want to squeeze in here also, of course, you know, is we have many stories, you know, being popularized today with the aspects of that there actually is descendants of Jesus, you know, alive today. Is that anything that you speculate upon or touch upon in your book?
I'm open to the possibilities. I mean, I have not seen anything to actually convince me of that. But I mean, I am certainly open to possibilities such as that. But from my reading, I've actually uncovered far more symbolic information contained within the Gospels pertaining to Jesus, because after all, he told the disciples that he spoke to the masses in parables, but to the apostles, he revealed to them what those parables really meant. And so I think, too, that whenever the apostles went and wrote down the Gospels, they were doing the same thing, and so you're given a nice story to read and understand, but it's only if you're really initiated into the secret teachings about such things that then you can start picking out these symbols and other meanings behind words and numbers that are found all throughout the text.
I don't know if you want to touch upon that, but I know that you, chapter in your book is called What's in a Name, I think, and in this chapter you go into a bit talking about the name of Jesus, and you connect it with a whole lot of, you know, very fascinating stuff. And I know that you even connect, you know, as we touched upon earlier, the pyramid itself, and even the pentagram, and a lot of other things. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Well, one of the big things, they had a lot of difficulty whenever they were trying to transliterate the name of Jesus, which was in Hebrew and Aramaic, would have been Yehoshua, into the Greek language to make it Jesus. And so I think it's very clever on their part, but they chose specific letters so that his name would add up to the number 888.
Yeah.
And it again, this is what I mean by it reveals all these other secrets once you understand this, because a lot of people are familiar whenever Jesus says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end." Well, it isn't just stressing his importance or having superiority over everything in the world, but but it also meant to the ancient Greeks that he had the entire power of the alphabet in his name, because words were power. And so whenever he says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, it was saying that his name stretched from the Alpha to the Omega. And whenever you lay out the Greek alphabet in this triple structure, it's three rows of eight letters each. You have 888.
Interesting. So it encompasses all of this, and of course we could, you know, we could go into a whole tangent of course on talking about how you know, words actually is a form of, or I've heard researchers refer to it as a form of magic, as it were. It is a, you know, you spell words, it's a spell, you know, in that way.
Yeah, I'm familiar. I've heard a lot of that too. I'm not sure, you know, how much I agree. I mean, a lot of it is very interesting studying the etymology of these words. But like I said, I just know that there's definitely a lot of symbolism contained within the Gospels that many people miss because they're not aware of these numeric values or other codes that are embedded within there.
For instance,
we can go into where a lot of people don't realize that there's a major connection between Jesus and serpent symbolism. I mean, for many that would seem blasphemous, but yet the Bible itself stresses this. One of the times they refer to, you know, Jesus being raised on the cross, they compare it to whenever Moses raised the brazen serpent up to heal the Israelites. So they make that comparison. But not only that, the Hebrew word nakash means serpent. And I can't remember off the top of my head, I think the numeric value of that adds up to 358. But then you have the term Mashiach, which evolved into Messiah. And that also adds up to 358. They specifically chose these words and made connections between them based upon the numeric values. And again, we can tie, you know, even Mashiach goes back to referring to these ancient dragon kings of the Sumerians and the Babylonians, because they had these dragons in their mythologies, or these serpent beings, a lot of times associated with the gods or divine power, and they were known as the Mesa, the Ushumgal, in different terms. But you can actually see, if you study the etymology, of how the term for the dragon evolved into the term for Messiah.
That's fascinating, you know, and we can always, I guess, even tie this into the legend of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent of the Mayan and the Inca and Aztec civilization. And I know also that you touch upon this a little bit in your book upon the, I mean, there are many pyramids and stuff over in South America also, of course. Would you attribute these beings as being actually behind all of these, you know, huge structures that is around still to this day? And we can't, if we were to try, we couldn't even, you know, begin to build something like the Great Pyramid, for instance. Would you say that these beings are behind it all?
I would say that they at least had a hand in it. I'm not ruling out human creators. For instance, like the Great Pyramid of Egypt, one of the theories that's been around for a while and is now gaining much more credibility is that the stones, not all of them, some of the stones were actually large blocks that were moved, but some of them were actually poured into place with this ready-made, almost cement mixture that the Egyptians created themselves. So I'm not ruling out the possibility of human inventors, but I will go so far as to say that I do think that these gods had a hand in it, or at least instructing them, because that's what our ancestors tell us. They say, yeah, we built this, or we at least had help with it, but we didn't do it alone, is what they keep saying. And you mentioned Quetzalcoatl. He's another one that the same kind of symbolism that's associated with Jesus. Again, he obviously has the serpent imagery associated with him. But he was also this favored figure that the people loved, and then he said he was leaving for a time and that one day he would return, and so people are awaiting his return. Now, what makes it interesting is he's closely associated with the planet Venus, which was known as the Morning Star or the Dawn Star.
Mm-hmm.
So that's intimately tied to him. A lot of people don't realize that the Morning Star is also directly associated with Jesus. They always tried to make it tied to Lucifer, which is correct, but in a short bit I can explain why we should disregard that as being literal and associate it maybe more properly with Jesus, simply because of what the Bible says. And in the book of Revelation, he says that I am the bright and morning star. Again, you have that symbolism of the morning star tying him to that. And the pentagram was often associated with the rulership of kings. And how we get that is because the ancient astronomers knew that whenever they tracked the movements of Venus in the sky, that every 584 days it would make this alignment so that they would plot the point in the sky, make a note of it, and wait for the cycle to repeat another 584 days, and after so many cycles, eventually it returned to the same position. Whenever they traced from point to point to point, it made a five-pointed star shape in the sky. So that is why the pentagram was a symbol of this kingship, and they derived it from tracking the movements of Venus.
That's so fascinating. There's incredible information, and what you did, I think, is also very fascinating. That you didn't you connect the letters even of Jesus himself with pointing to in a counterclockwise. Well, you tell us about it if you want to, of course.
Yeah, sure. Part of that is actually not tying the biblical name of Jesus, but what was later invented by ceremonial magicians, like during the Renaissance times, where they were deeply connected and studied the Kabbalah. And the most holy name of God was Yahweh. And I'm sorry, I apologize to any devout Jewish listeners who might be offended that I am actually pronouncing the name or attempting to pronounce the name. But I'm just speaking of that name now, that it was considered the ineffable name, and it wasn't meant to be pronounced. So part of the reason was that they said that if it was properly pronounced, either all of the world would end, or it would grant some sort of super powers to whoever possessed the knowledge of that name. So they didn't speak it because they revered it so much. So later on, the ceremonial magicians, what they did during the Renaissance period was that they took some letters out of the Hebrew alphabet, one of them being the letter Sheen. And to them, that represented spirit. So they inserted it into the middle of the name of God. And so then they got this hybrid form of Yehoshua. Now, again, like I said, it's not biblically authentic, but it's still connecting to this ancient belief system where Jesus would say, in his name you can cast out demons and things like that. Although just speaking his name, as the Bible shows, did not actually cast out the demon. You had to be well-versed in how to properly use the name. And that is what a lot of these ceremonial magicians were interested in, because whenever they had this five-letter name of Jesus, known as the Pentagrammaton, they could place the letters upon the points of that five-pointed star, and whenever they did it in a counterclockwise fashion, it was used for banishing rituals. So while it's just speculation, I'm just merely suggesting that I think it's the ceremonial magicians were trying to keep alive a tradition that was known from the ancient times, but they themselves didn't completely understand everything.
And isn't it fascinating, you know, that these days a pentagram from a Christian viewpoint in that sense is attributed to very, you know, in a way it's viewed upon, I guess, in a very evil way or something occult, or, you know, and that's very interesting, because this information, in a sense, I think, actually bridged the gap between these things, because this a pentagram is, associated with paganism or you know, more ancient religion. But if we interpret it this way, there actually is a connection between them, as you say, the pentagram and, you know, ancient, at least, Christianity, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, again, it's all throughout the Bible if you just know where to look for it. Like I said, with the pentagrammaton, that was invented by the ceremonial magicians, but I think they were keeping alive this tradition because, remember I said that Jesus was supposed to be of the priesthood of Melchizedek. Well, Melchizedek was known as the high priest of Salem. Now, they think that's the precursor to Jerusalem, which it very well might be. However, the original name for Jerusalem was Shalom, which isn't the Shalom, which means peace, but it actually was probably derived from Shalom, which was referring to this deity in the ancient Mesopotamian area, which was connected to the five-pointed star, or the pentagram. And they've uncovered, archaeologists have found ancient seals and things from ancient Jerusalem, whenever it was known as Shalom, with a five-pointed star representing the symbol of the city.
And so,
once again, like I said, Jesus is connected to Melchizedek and, you know, deeply connected to Jerusalem, and that was the ancient symbol, but back at that time, it did not have a negative connotation.
Yeah.
They viewed the pentagram as a symbol of kingship and authority, and it was only over time, as misunderstandings came about, that it was eventually turned into a negative symbol, and even then, many people fail to see the difference between an uprighted pentagram and an inversed pentagram. To the ancient people, there wasn't really a difference because even if you track Venus, like I was mentioning, over time, it alternates between an upright and an inverted pentagram shape in the sky.
Oh, really? Oh,
yes. It takes 160 years, but it inverts between both forms.
Fascinating. Yeah, definitely.
So it wasn't until more recent times whenever, like even in the 20th century with modern-day Satanists, where they basically hijacked this symbol and they used it because it suited their purposes. And so many people today who don't fail or who fail to study all of the ancient texts and understand how this was involved, they only see what's being used in the modern world. And so all these rock bands and everyone who's using the pentagram, they're doing it because it suits their purposes now, but it's not that authentic, really.
So ironic, in a way. Do you think that there is actually power in symbols?
I definitely think there's power in symbols. Whether or not it actually grants somebody supernatural powers, I find that debatable. I haven't seen any evidence that it actually grants someone direct powers of God or anything like that. But I do think that the symbols are powerful because they can convey messages that are understood cross-culturally. So if there was a message left to us in the ancient world and they wanted us to be able to read it in the modern day, we have a much better chance of trying to understand it through symbols because you don't have the language barriers.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You know, we're so quickly running out of time here, and there's so much more I want to ask you about and talk about. There's this fascinating discussion, but before we continue in the subscriber section and move on into the next segment, I would leave the floor open for you here for a few minutes and talk about the book a little bit and how people can get it, of course, and also mention your website again so people will know, how they can get it from you.
Sure. The book's title is Gateway of the Gods, and the website is the same name, so they just need to hit gatewayofthegods.com. They'll be able to find all the information there. The book is available all throughout the United States and the United Kingdom, so any bookstore can order it. If it's not on the shelf, just ask them to order it. They can get it for you. It's also available at online retailers such as Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. Or, like I said, you can order directly from me, and I will even autograph the books for anyone who orders from me through the website.
Nice.
If they want to order by telephone, they can call a toll-free number. It's 1-877-450-4634. That's 1-877-450-4634. And then they can just leave a message with their name and credit card information and, what they'd like to order, and the publisher will send that out right away.
Excellent. So the book is called Gateway of the Gods, and the website, of course, again, then is gatewayofthegods.com. Do check it out, and we're going to take a short break, but thank you so much for this segment, Craig, and we will continue in the subscriber section.
No, you're quite welcome. Thank you.
We are going to continue with Craig now in the subscriber section, and we are going to dive into much more of the material that we didn't get to in the first segment. We are going to talk more about the ancient record, what's the connection to 2012, the sun and the global warming issue or climate change. We are also going to talk about EVPs, electric voice phenomena, the realm of the dead, and some of the potentials with the new technology and new scientific research, but also about spiritual development through practices like alchemy, and is there in any way a relation between secret societies and the information that we have been talking about here today. Much more good stuff with Craig Haynes coming up in the subscriber section. Before we finish off this segment, I also want to mention that in the transition over to July, we are going to bump up our subscription rates. So this is a great time to take advantage of the low rates of our 3 months or 6 month subscription options. Stop by our website redicecreations.com for much more information about everything. How to subscribe, how to participate in the radio show, how to join the forum, etc. And you can of course follow along our news section for important and interesting news stories from all different kinds of fields from around this planet and beyond. Thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren, we will be back on Thursday again with our regular guest Michael Tesserion. Thank you so much for tuning into the program. This is Henrik Palmgren. Take good care and we'll talk more soon.
I've been stuffed in your pocket for the last 100 days. When I don't get my bath, I take it out on the slaves. So grease up your baby for the ball on the hill. I'll polish them rockets now and swallow those pills and say, oh. My name, you're through my core.